Welcome back to The Cast of Us, the Incomparables episode-by-episode recap of HBO's The Last of Us. It's the show for people who love guns and emotions. And wait, it's okay. No, it's over. We're not fighting. My name's Brian. What's yours, Ben McCarthy?
My name is Ben. Last I checked.
Oh. I guess I answered that for you.
Thank you.
Tiff Arment, have I satisfied the necessary conditions for you to talk?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, all right. I'll show up. My rider's been met.
Cool. I'll put the gun down. And who's that asking for help in the road? Are we going to go help him out? Nope. It's Merlin Mann. How you doing, Merlin?
It's my second day in a car, man.
Or it's a spaceship, like from Last of Us 2. Anyway, thank you so much for tuning back in to Season 1, Episode 4. Please hold to my hand. And before we jump on in, we do have one piece of follow-up for a segment I like to call Pascal Patrol. Pedro Pascal was on SNL, and they gave us the greatest gift that SNL has given us since, I think, Diner Lobster, HBO's Mario Kart. Because they adapted one video game into a prestige TV show, they made a gritty reboot of Mario Kart, and Chris Pratt could never do as well as Pedro Pascal did, saying, "It's a me, Mario."
I'm going to take credit for this because totally in our first episode, I mentioned something about the dramatization of Mario, so I'm taking credit for this. They stole my idea. They obviously listened to our show and took that.
I don't watch a lot of SNL, but am I right in thinking that is the highest quality CGI they've ever done in a bit?
Oh, stuff on
the details
track
were
bananas.
Insane.
Yeah.
They had like all the little things in the background, like it was perfection. I loved it.
For whatever reason, Pedro Pascal looms large in our house, sometimes for different reasons. Not as big as Taika Waititi or Carl Urban, but you know, he's up there for us. And so all week we've all been like, what is it going to be like? And I was like, my only big hope, I mean, we were doing like an internal, like a Snell style draft of like who would play Ellie. My money was on Sarah Sherman. But I said, the only thing I really hope though is I hope they don't just... I haven't called this doing a Garth Brooks, where you bring somebody out, you put them in a dress, you have them talk in a funny voice, and it's, you know, it's not exactly like Monty Python level comedy, but when they did bring him out dressed as a woman with a beard, it was really, really funny. And I want to just, in terms of Mario, I want to just applaud this thing where, like, I don't know how they managed to do this inside of a week, but the idea of, like, you know, they've done a lot of these that are really funny. The one with David Harbour, that's the gritty reboot of Oscar the Grouch. Did you ever see that one?
Yes, that was David good Harbour. Too.
It's supposed to be, where it's supposed to be, yeah, you know, like if, what's his head? Or like basically the Joker, but like.
Oh, the Joker.
Yeah, I guess I'm trash. I love stuff like that and the production. Or, you know, for example, the like Wes Anderson horror film one, stuff like that. I think that's a fun way to utilize a talented person without, you know, having them have to memorize a lot of times. And finally, Pedro Pascal, best breaking ever. When he's breaking in the dinner sketch, I think it's so funny because it's not that he just finds it so funny. And then he gets Bowen Yang, of all people, who rarely breaks. And I know Lauren Michaels hates this, but I give this episode, that episode, of high marks. And good for keeping up with the culture, with a, what is it, a 60-year-old game? How old Mario Kart?
I don't know. Is it me, or is he getting hotter?
Mm-hmm. Yes, he is getting hotter.
He's
yes.
certainly leaning
I feel
into
like
the
he's getting
thing.
Like so much hotter since The Mandalorian. And, you know, I preferred The Mandalorian with helmet on. You know, I found that to be hotter. But now I'm like, I'm all about his look. I'm so into him.
I
all
think
of a
the
sudden.
Graying helps a lot of men. There's that old saw that's, I don't know, it's a little bit gross. But that whole idea of, like, you know, women attain the height of their power somewhere around the time they also have the height of their beauty is an old idea. And that men continue to accumulate power and actually strangely get better looking or more get more character or whatever as they get old. Setting that aside, though, Michael Che, he's getting gray hair and he looks great. I think there's something to be said about getting ladies. Try it. Get older.
I mean, Steve Carell, right? He got super hot. So I'm totally into the I'm into the Pedro here.
I'd hit prison, Mike.
I like him a lot.
My favorite thing is Pedro reacting to all the videos of him being called daddy on the internet. Because he seemed really weirded out by it at first, and then he just leaned
into it. Yeah, you're
going
to need to link that.
Please send it to me in Slack. Going in the show notes.
I will watch that later. Thank you.
Tiff, I don't know if you got this quite because your youngster is younger than my youngster, but it was a very funny moment on the couch as Madeline and I laughed up. But of course, we're always getting constant running commentary about what everybody gets wrong about TikTok and every TV show. And like, oh, that's a joke you would make, Dad, which is not a compliment. But we're, Madeline and I are both just laughing. I don't know what bias, like what does all of this mean? What do these words mean? And Billy was like, oh, you want to know? And I was like, actually, I super don't. But like, I guess all of this, like I'd heard the term fan, what's it called, a fan duel, a fan edit,
fan cast.
Is that where you like do a super cut of somebody you think is hot?
I don't know.
Thirst trap.
I think even Brian and me are too old for this.
Yeah, I'm too old for this.
But the things they were making of him as the teacher, and I love the way he played his utter bewilderment at like. Before he even gets to how inappropriate it is, he was just like, I don't understand why you do this every time. So funny.
It's COVID.
COVID. Oh, because COVID.
Yeah, because COVID. Speaking of because COVID, we get to talk about The Last of Us, which was filmed during COVID, which is shocking to me given how high production value the entire freaking show is. We open on Ellie practicing looking badass while she fires a gun into a mirror. You can see how inexperienced she is with a gun. She drops a bullet when trying to reload. She cocks a gun. It goes flying everywhere.
But she did remember to take the one out of the chamber. So that, to me, is experience.
You know more
she
about guns than I
do. She shoot herself in the face. So...
She went to Fedra school with guns.
She did.
Oh, yeah, that's right, because she held the gun later with and said, oh, that's the Fedra grip. But interesting.
Yeah, she did know to remove the one from the chamber before she was, like, actually pulling the trigger at herself in the mirror. So, like, that to me said that she did know her way around, but she was very clumsy with it because she doesn't have the experience. But she at least had some knowledge.
The way she handled it and the way she smelled it
really reminded me
of how like somebody that age would interact with a pistol. Because the first time you pick up a pistol, I feel like the first thing you realize it's so much heavier than you think. You'll eventually also realize it is about 1,000 times louder than you think. If you've ever gone to a gun range, there's a reason they wear those earmuffs, guys. And I thought she played that really nicely. She wasn't playing it big. It was just a little kind of like a personal moment, and it was. I don't know. I mean, not to get too high-minded, but like sort of emblematic of like, yeah, she's growing up and she's got a gun now. And like, but it also just like, I got a gun.
Ben, you were going to say?
I was just going to check in with Merlin because I believe your kid is playing through the game or games at the moment. And I just wanted to have an idea of how far into the game you've seen. And, you know, should we be avoiding spoiling you any further than this episode or anything?
That's okay. My kid's on TikTok, so he knows everything, apparently. But, I've seen Citizen Kane. You just saw the snow globe rolling around. That's not the movie.
Wait a minute.
No, come on.
There's no Kane in Citizen Kane.
Spoilers. But the, just that, so basically we bought this a long time ago. Syracuse was kind enough a few years ago to, like, kind of get my legs under me, help me like get set up with the whole idea of my first gaming console I've owned since an Atari 20. Well, that's not true. Atari 2600 when I was in my 30s. I bought one at a flea market used. Even then in the 90s, it was for nostalgia. No, but we'd had, you know, Wii and stuff like that. But getting a PS4 a few years ago was a big step forward. And I happily took his advice on what games to look at. And so he turned us on to some games. A lot of the games y'all are familiar with, like along these lines, each game came with a specific admonition about how I wasn't allowed to play until I got good enough. But that included things like The Last of Us, obviously. Shadow of the Colossus, I think, was one that I was specifically admonished not to play. and the one that I love that Billy just finished not long before this was Life is Strange, which I thought was extraordinary. So I haven't listened to that episode yet, but I love that. So yeah, so I played just a little bit of it. Let's just keep it friendly and say I'm not a big fan of video games. It's not a thing I do. I fill out forms online is mainly my video game. But then I watched him play. He just finished on Friday, part one remastered, and is currently on part two. So yeah, that's where we are with that. But I'm generally aware. I had been aware generally of the story, but again, so much stuff in this that wasn't how it went in the video game, and I think that's
like crazy word for word, right? Like the scene with them in the car. Yeah, that was exactly. exactly word for word. So, Ben, I don't know where you are with your playthrough, but since I just started my playthrough, I'm trying to like keep up with where we're at as we're talking about it and as I'm playing.
What a crazy thing to say. You wouldn't say that about Space Invaders. By the way, Space Invaders is a video game from a long time ago.
Did you see the dramatization of Space Invaders?
I'm up to the part where it gets a little harder. Oh, man. Be careful. No spoilers, but it gets even harder. Oh, man.
It gets faster. And it wasn't intentional. Oh, it's come a long way since Pac-Man.
I was doing my playthrough on the grounded difficulty, which is the hardest and most punishing because I've played through this game so many times. I live for the torture of it. But I played through all of that, got to the end, and then immediately dove into another game. And I was like, this time I want to try the permadeath setting where if you die once, that's it, game over, back to start.
Oh, now I'm feeling inferior because I'm only playing on hard. Damn it.
But I turned the difficulty down to normal. So I was like, okay, we'll give this a shot. And I was playing through it all going pretty well. And then I got to the hotel basement and just got absolutely destroyed in seconds. And I was like, okay, let's not do that again.
Yeah, I can mess
with it. Imagine playing all that time and then having a monkey kill you. That sucks. Oof.
Yeah, it's. I love Ellie's relationship with weapons in the show, because in the game it's kind of taken for granted. Oh yeah, Ellie has a knife. That's fine. Whatever. Later you get a bow and arrow. Seeing her kind of learn to have a gun in real life and how cool she feels when she fires at herself in the mirror, it's like, we know how she's going to feel later in the show, now that we have, you know, seen it and we're recapping it. The idea that it's not cool to have a gun and fire it at a thing or person, seeing her expectations versus the reality she gets later is one of my favorite parts of this particular episode. She puts the gun into Chekhov's backpack and walks outside. Joel is siphoning gas from a car. Literally in this moment, I asked, oh, how are they going to explain away gas deterioration? Next thing out of Joel's mouth was, oh yeah, gas breaks down over time. This stuff's almost water. And my entire house went, oh, Brian, you got it! It was a very fun moment.
That, you know what? Treasure that. You're not going to get a lot of those in life. What a good feeling. You nailed it. Now, can you explain siphoning to me? Don't overthink it.
I know it works. I know there's a coffee
siphon. It's the principles of water adhesion. No kidding.
I only know the bit where you get a mouthful of gasoline before spitting it out.
Right.
Yeah, I too have seen green.
That seems like the important part.
Back in the day, we can go 10 to 12 hours on a single tank. And where did you go? Nowhere. I like that little like world building moment, but the idea that they have to stop every single freaking hour, it's like they own a Tesla from 2011. And so Ellie pulls out the pun book, exactly like in the game. My favorite pun in the entire episode was algae bra. Are these exactly puns from the game, or do they invent new ones for people that have actually been playing the game recently?
The envelope one is definitely in there.
Yeah, definitely. The others I didn't recognize so much. The scarecrow and the algae bra.
There was another really good one in the game that I laughed out loud while I was playing it, and I can't think of what it was now, but yeah, I'm definitely sure about the envelope.
I love Pedro Pascal's growth in having chuckled a little bit and being annoyed to outright laughing towards the episode ending. I really appreciate
that
little bit of
arc.
Sweet. So sweet.
Yeah, I love that end part where they just laugh together. Well, we should talk about that in order because it comes after so much stress, right? Like the way Ellie breaks that, it's just great. But I like the changes that they made here where they're taking a break from driving and we're seeing them like camping in the woods. And we are hearing a lot of the same conversations that they had in the game, but now they're just kind of in a little bit more practical settings because obviously in the game you're trudging through and these conversations are just kind of happening as you're walking from battle to battle. But in this, we have a lot more world building where we're kind of like showing the stresses of the environment where they are actually like trying to hide from people. They're trying to be very stealthy about, you know, making sure that there's no fire to attract attention. And we're seeing their actual journey, which I think is very, very cool. I like those changes.
What is your opinion on sleeping on the ground versus sleeping in the truck for safety?
The ground seems more comfortable, honestly.
The ground definitely seems more comfortable, but when you know what's out there.
What, deer?
People,
infected? I don't know. The truck just seems safer.
Yeah, I guess if you're closed up in the truck. I thought about that too, though. You're not the only one who thought about
that. I bet it's, at least in some ways, I know nothing about this, but I imagine in some ways it's about options. Mm-hmm. Like, you'd be pretty easy to quickly surround in a truck. Whereas you could like sneak through a hole theoretically if you're like inside of the everything all at once laundromat.
You might be able to hear better too if you're outside. Mm-hmm. Like to open. And as we saw, they didn't. I mean, you know, Joel didn't really sleep. Joel wasn't really asleep like that whole night. So I think about him just like running on absolute fumes. Like when they start finally climbing those stairs, like after everything went through, we saw him kind of like standing guard and letting Ellie sleep because he wasn't comfortable sleeping out there alone.
Yeah, we know that he is not getting very much sleep during this section of the story. The one other thing I wanted to cover before we jump into the camping is in the aforementioned porn mag scene, we see Ellie kind of give Joel a look and think, let me throw in a little something extra for this conversation before she says, oh, why are all these pages stuck together? Like, you can see the moment where she decides to prod him with an extra uncomfortable question. And that's something that I don't think was in the game, that little moment that Belly Ramsey
brought
to this. Oh, that little moment?
The whole that whole thing in the car, word for word, exact cutscene from the game.
There's a really interesting tension with Ellie's innocence versus maturity. Because you get the sense, like, yeah, she's experienced quite a bit in her 14 years, but also has not experienced any of the outside world.
That actress has such an interesting look. Of course, I loved her on Game of Thrones, King of the North. She has such an interesting look. The family was talking about this last night. She has one of those faces, a very unusual face, but also it's like I think she's in real life. I think she goes by she. But is like, I think 17 or 18, right, in real life. But like, she's one of those people who could play like 9 or 22. Mm-hmm. Like, you know what I mean? It's she has kind of, and like, it's really in how she carries herself, does the line reading, the physicality. Or like, you know, for example, the whole like, this sounds like an idiotic thing to say, but if I'd never handled a gun in my life and somebody handed me a gun, the first thing I'd probably do is like, do the Travis Bickle thing and like point it at a mirror as well, because I bet I look cool pointing this at somebody is a thought that anybody would have, I imagine, the first time you pick up a pistol. And the way that she plays it, anyway, I think y'all are really onto it though. The way that she, like a real teenager, has some aspects of her personality that are wildly overdeveloped and others that are the result of, you know, 14 years at Ferta. You know, like she's, sorry, I got Letterkenny on the head. Every time I see Fedra, I think Ferta. But that's the other interesting part is like, this is her first time out in the world. I'm sure y'all talked about this already, but there's a lot you could cover in this. And I feel like it's its own kind of effort just to decide what to put in at what point and then what it does in the service of the story.
We get so much more of the car ride than in the game, which I was a little disappointed in the game, where they leave Boston, smash cut to Pittsburgh, the car crashes. In this, they really spend a lot more time having those conversations in the car and doing some beautiful aerial photography of the dilapidated world that, you know, the nature has overgrown and reclaimed those bits. The tanks that they drive by after Ellie was very excited to see some tanks. The tanks really reminded me of all the Guardians in Hyrule in Breath of the Wild, in that one area where everything's grown over and you can explore all of them and get all the gears. Again, video games on the brain, thanks to the fact that this is The Last of Us.
I thought when they were in the forest looking up at the stars as well, just another nice reminder of, yes, the apocalypse has happened, but nature reclaiming everything actually has some nice upsides to it. Everything just looks gorgeous and vibrant.
It really makes me think of that book, The World Without Us. Has anyone read that?
Ooh,
it's about how the world will decay when humans are gone. So like, as if there were no humans to maintain anything.
Oh, I saw something on TV about that.
Yes, they made a terrible TV show about it.
But it's kind of about like, here's the things you could expect in this amount of time. Here's the things in that amount of... It reminds me a little bit, this is going to be an odd reference, but it reminds me a little bit of the Planet of the Apes remake. Like what San Francisco looks like when it's like... Or I guess
too close to home.
Well, it's already falling apart, don't worry. But I thought that too. I mean, like, I'm sure you guys have covered this too, but like, just the production design, the world building of all of this is so extraordinary. The show is so much more beautiful and detailed than it needs to be, and I'm really grateful for it.
They got the HBO budget behind it.
I can't believe like the parallels that are with the game. I think it's just a huge testament to like Naughty Dog's vision of the story, the dialogue, the music, the set design. Like, everything was there already. And a whole bunch of us who played it knew that. You know what I mean? Like, we knew everything that was going into this. And then to see it readapted onto a screen in like this great precision. And it's like they didn't skimp on anything, of course, you know, budget reasons, but like they didn't change it in such a way that it feels like, oh, okay, now because this is a real world, like we can actually make movie magic and like it can be so much more than what a game was. It's not. It's like it's the same. It feels the same, like playing along with the same at the same time as watching the show now that I've caught up. It's like I'm just watching the episodes twice. And I think that that is amazing because it's showing that there was so much in just a stupid video game that can now translate into this beautiful drama with so much heart and this 14-year-old girl and her like, you know, immaturity and yet her toughness, like showing through the relationship between these characters. This episode really moved forward the Joel and Ellie relationship so much, and it also put Ellie into such a adult position but yet having child emotional reactions to it, because with her and the gun and, you know, having to use it for the first time and then dealing with that with Joel, like it is amazing that that was already there. And they brought it to now a larger audience that gets to enjoy it without having to, like, be a gamer. And I feel so thankful that so many more people are able to now enjoy this story, especially, like, someone like you, Merlin, right? Like, you are now finally getting to, like, see this mm-hmm. incredible story that, like, people like us and Syracusa, like, have been raving about for years and have fallen in love with.
Actually... Well, believe it or not, I was admonished about something by John Syracuse. It'd be hard to
believe. Oh my God, were you? What?
I know, you guys, it's crazy. I wrote it down in my diary. But I was specifically admonished, no, don't just go watch a playthrough of this. Like, you know, it's a game. You have to play it. And I absolutely get that.
No, you don't. Just watch this.
Are you going to throw down with Squidward about this?
Oh yeah, I am. I love poking that bear.
At this point, it's Yumi and Casey against the flying monkeys. What? This is almost the definition of a job I would not want. Along the lines of maybe like, you know, having to direct a Star Wars movie. Like you think about the impossible, seemingly impossible situation of, on the one hand, the people who care intensely about the source material. For me, that might be something like a Confederacy of Dunces. I hope I wouldn't be as horrible as, you know, a video game person would be. But, like, there's certain pieces of literature and art that I have such a emotional long-term relationship with that if you didn't show this one scene, this one way, if you didn't have her little pink, like, keychain thing hanging off her backpack, or if you got it wrong, I think, understandably, people would be pretty miffed if you skipped a scene that you thought was really important. Like, those people understandably have such a sense of almost ownership that they want the steward of this project to honor the video game. Now, good luck amongst millions of people who play this video game making a version of that. Even if you made something just for fans, they were just going to show at a convention. Good luck making all of them happy, because believe me, they would all have notes. But then on the complete other side of this, you are the most prestigious creator of TV content today, at least in my opinion. Certainly the most, that's the one I watch the most. The most stuff I think about a lot comes from HBO. So how do you take a video game, and to be a little cynical here, how do you take a video game and turn into something that somebody who doesn't like video games would like? Now, how do you square those two? How do you begin to square that in a way that says, well, we're going to courageously tell the story that we want to tell in the way that we want to tell. And again, as with Chernobyl, that requires some upfront thinking about what the rules are. You know, the sort of Bible of the show about how we'll do this. But I mean, it's so difficult for me to criticize anything about this because I haven't played the game, but also because I'm just really kind of in awe of the fact that as somebody who's somewhere in between those two poles, I'm thoroughly enjoying it. And I just endless aloha and kudos for having the guts to like take on these two incredibly paradoxical, contradictory goals.
I think that's the brilliance of having both Neil Druckmann and Craig Mazin involved. Sorry. Because Druckmann has been involved in this for 10 plus years. This, you know, presumably they've been working on it for years before it was released. So he's got to be as intimately familiar with this world as anyone could possibly be. And then you've got Craig Mazin, who is a self-proclaimed fan of it, but you know, comes in as an outsider, doesn't have that same level of attachment, and can question these aspects of the world, going like, okay, it's a compelling story, but, you know, maybe Joel needs a little bit more motivation for trying to bring Ellie to Tommy. And so what if Tommy goes missing and now there's two incentives to get out into the world? That kind of thing. Like, if it was just Druckmann, we might just end up with a remake of the game because, you know, he's already demonstrated that that's the story he wanted to tell. And if it was just, as we've seen all too often, an adaptation where somebody else, some outsider comes in, takes over a franchise and goes, this is how I see it, that all too often ends in complete disaster. So having two hands on the wheel, so to speak, I think has obviously worked out really well.
I can't think of many other modern video games where you can take a scene verbatim from a game and put it on a screen with, you know, real actors doing a lot of real, you know, nuanced performances without motion capture, and it would come across this well and beautiful. And I think, again, to believe Tiff's earlier point, the fact that The Last of Us was so filmable from the beginning means that it translates so well to the screen, but they change the things that they're presenting you with from the video game to the show, because we're not going to be watching them, you know, spend hours and hours avoiding guards to try to get from one scene to another. We can kind of skip past that, but then really fill in the gaps between when they leave Boston and arrive in Pittsburgh in the game and Kansas City in the show, where they can really start to establish those relationships that we kind of missed in the main game. And this episode in particular, like, again, to your point, Tiff, where they are really spending a lot of time fleshing out that relationship, I love the fact that this is kind of a break from the rest of the show. This is the most TV show episode of Last of Us so far. And I don't say that disparagingly. I think we need different changes of pace. Mm-hmm. If we got 9 Bill and Franks, we would be freaking devastated by the end of March. And I can't believe that they were able to maintain that momentum for 3 episodes with a huge pilot, really intense second episode with a death of Tess, and then Bill and Frank in episode 3. We really got a break this episode. There's no 2003 flashbacks. There's no massive set pieces. There's some, but not, you know, huge, huge. And I really appreciate the fact that we get this, like, softer time and see them laughing by the end of the show, despite everything that's happened. And I really appreciate that.
It's a lot more familiar, certainly, as just format of TV show. Two characters walking along, kind of getting to know each other, and then drama happens to them.
But again, it's just like the damn game. Like, I can't even freaking believe it. Anyway, take us away, Brian. Where else are we headed here?
I can talk to y'all about all of these details for hours, but just to make sure this episode isn't 4 hours long. It's morning. Joel and Ellie wake up. They eat at Chez Joel, which the day before was Chef Boyardee ravioli from 20 years ago, and the next morning is crappy percolated coffee, which is from 20 years ago that Bill and Frank have been hoarding. Ellie has never had coffee and thinks, oh, what the F is that? Oh, it's gross. It smells like burning shit. I really love when Apocalypse Media talks about coffee in that way. It comes up in The Last of Us 2 that Joel, like, has one cup of coffee a month because it's so rare and scarce at that point that he can't drink it as often as people today do, which I really appreciate. And then 25 hours in the car to Cody, Wyoming, which is when Joel decides to talk about his brother Tommy and the way that he jumped into Desert Storm right out of high school and therefore joined the Fireflies. Merlin, for your context, in earlier episodes of this show, we talked about how, surprise, this show is actually about 9/11 because they set it back 10 years. I'm like, oh, interesting. Because the game takes place in 2013 and therefore 2023. But because culture froze in 2013, it doesn't necessarily matter. But because culture froze 2 years after 9/11, we have so much more of the tribalism and the kind of division between different groups, which leads to things like the resistance we see in Kansas City and the Fireflies and Tommy joining them being as idealistic as he is. It's a really interesting compromise between setting the date of the show back to include those things from the early 2000s that just couldn't exist.
That's so fascinating. And it's funny because just today, doesn't matter, but I was recording a show with John Roderick and I was talking about how I was enjoying the program we're talking about. And I was, you know, we both are big fans of Chernobyl. And I specifically said to John, like, I know you don't listen to podcasts, but like, you should check out the companion podcast for Chernobyl, which I can honestly say for anybody who enjoyed Chernobyl, I imagine most of you like podcasts and you've probably heard it, but it's so fascinating to hear Craig Mazin talk about all of that decision making. All the questions that anybody would bring up, like all questions will be answered. Like, why does everybody have an English accent? How come everything's in Cyrillic? But then, you know, like all those decisions that went into deciding. The big point I'm struggling to make here is that there's a famous quote that's been attributed to Roger Ebert where he supposedly said, it's not what a movie is about, it's how a movie is about it. And I mean, I think another way to put that might be, you know, did they succeed at what they were trying to do? Patrick Willems has a really good new like hour and a half long video about this idea of like how to watch a movie and how to think about movies. And that's his basis for everything. Now, part one, what happened in this? And then part two, why did it happen like this? Not to get, you know, too far into the weeds necessarily about intention, but more to understand, take everything in this as something intentional. Yes, you can go too far and turn into the Room 237 people, but you can watch something and then go like, well, if there was an accident, they left in that accident. That was a decision. Everything on the screen, we should trust that the person meant this to happen. And when it's somebody so capable, somebody, you take something like this, you take something like Watchmen, you take something like Leftovers, like some of my favorite shows. And I think it becomes so engrossing to really ask what story they're telling and how they're telling it. This is a bit much bigger macro issue than like, quote, was it like the video game? Well, let's not worry for a second about whether this is a video game movie. Let's worry about a story that we want to tell, how we're going to tell it. And like how everything in this is going to amplify, whether that's Chekhov's backpack or like, you know, boy, can I just never be strangled with a gun, please? But like that's all comes down to what story you want to tell and how you want to tell it. And that's what makes somebody, I don't want to just lionize Craig Mazin, but many of my favorite storytellers are people who have thought like a lot about this. Again, look at Andor and how Andor, like those first three episodes are an act of a season. And when you guys talk about this fourth episode being kind of like a little, there's probably a name in the Doctor Who community for this, but like you've got all this bam, bam, bam stuff that happens. And then there's a little bit of like, well, now we're going to have some character time, right? That's a very, to state the obvious, a very deliberate decision. And I will never get sick of hearing people talk about how you make that kind of decision, because all of that, even with a quote unquote big budget, well, no budget's ever big enough. I got friends that make Star Wars and no budget is ever big enough for what people want. And so I don't know, that to me, like I find it endlessly fascinating, like any show that rewards your careful attention and any show who's after that careful attention, you find yourself turning it over in your mind about how and why they did it that way. To me, that's what being a fan is all about.
My running theory is that each episode is about an element of Joel's personality or insecurities or whatever. And we see like the Bill and Frank episode is about, you know, Joel's fear of letting people in, and Tess was about his, you know, hope for the future and, you know, how he doesn't have that but learns to get it again. And I think this episode is kind of we look at Melanie Linsky's character, and I think she's going to be the, what if Joel had kind of never recovered from the outbreak sort of situation. And we know that he did some bad things in the past, and I'm just like, what if that was his only story?
You know what she's going to be? No spoilers, she's going to be the governor.
Yeah. Oh my God.
She's going to be the David Morrissey character.
I think we see her a little bit cutesy but brutal in this episode, and I think next episode is going to be a lot more of the brutality.
Right.
Yeah, speaking of things that aren't with the game, that whole faction, like knowing anything really about them, right? Isn't that like not at all?
Yeah,
that's all
kinda just
new.
They're kind of just goons in the game.
Yeah, in the game, and they're all men. They're like all just like, let's get them.
Yeah, they personify this group. They had the truck, which was very creepy. I remember
which scene in the game? What I remember them from?
There's like a whole segment in Pittsburgh instead of Kansas City.
They do the whole same exact thing where they're going down the highway. They kind of get duped by someone feigning injury, and then they crash into a store or whatever. The same exact thing as the game. And you have like a whole shootout
thing.
Speaking
of which, how great was that thing where she's like, did you ever kill an innocent person? I was waiting for him to say, well, nobody's innocent. But I thought that was a nice moment in this, not a nice moment, but like it was really painful. And like it's in these moments of downtime and where you don't feel immediately vulnerable, like physically, where like that's where you become truly like sort of emotionally vulnerable. And I thought that was a nice moment. Like, did I understand right? She's basically asking, well, was that ever you? Did you ever like throw cinder blocks through people's windows to be able to kill them and take their stuff?
Yeah.
And he says, no comment.
Yeah.
I declined to
comment. In the words of my kid, Joel has done some bad stuff.
Yeah. It's one way of putting it.
But yeah, this is definitely just, they're fleshing out this whole idea of that the city is taken over by a whole group of people that didn't want to be under the Fedra law. Mm-hmm. And so they're kind of like living on their own, but they're also like have become now their own militant group. And what they were doing in the game was they would stop anyone who would come into the city and basically kill them for food, shoes, clothing, like everything that they would have on them, and just like, they were scavengers.
Oh, so in that case, it's really kind of more like Terminus than the governor.
Yes.
A little bit. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Like that. And then so now that Joel and Ellie had to like find their way out of the city in order to escape this like, you know, murderous group that's just after supplies.
Right.
And now they're extra mad because now they like killed people from their group. And so, you know, it makes sense. But I like that they took it a little bit further and we got to see some of like the interior workings of this group in the city.
They did a really smart thing in creating the characters of Kathleen and Perry, played by Melanie Linsky, my absolute favorite, and Jeffrey Pierce, who played Tommy in the original Last of Us. They brought him in and gave him a new character. And I think the way they expounded on these characters that live in the city and made these scary things we saw in the game even more scary by showing us the people behind it was absolutely incredible. It also looked like from the featurette after the show, they changed it from Pittsburgh to Kansas City because Calgary looked a lot more like Kansas City than Pittsburgh, and it would be a little bit cheaper to change it.
According to Stephen King, that also wasn't what Boston looks like a little bit to the west.
No.
That's what he said. I mean, he's from Maine. What does he know?
I wish we had someone from Boston on the podcast.
I assume it just was like a better route for them to take. And, I've got no sense of American geography, especially the kind of Midwest, the middle states. So I was like, yeah, whatever they're doing, it's fine with
you. You think we do? Oh, my goodness.
It helped them move them across the country.
There's a reason
too.
We're called coastal elites, not coastal integrators.
It really helped them move them across the country a little bit faster, too, than I think, like, you know, only in Pittsburgh from Boston. That is not very far.
No.
So this kind of helped them move them a little bit more.
But as we learn later, if Ellie hadn't been there, Joel would be in Wyoming by now. This sequence where they crash into the laundromat is the most, like the game, human action sequence we've seen so far. In episode 2, we had the clickers in the museum in Boston. That was very, very much like the game from a clicker action zombie perspective. But this scene of them fighting the people with the guns in the laundromat is the most like fighting the guards or fighting human characters that the show has done so far. And thank God it was only, what, 3 or 4 minutes and not the first, you know, 4 hours of the game that we have to keep doing this.
Yeah, and they also didn't make it very gruesome either, because there was that scene in the game where they showed, like, besides maybe, like, the pile of burned bodies that they had in the show, they kept the gruesome out of it. And we've discussed that before, that was very much a choice that the show is making. And I really appreciate that they don't extend it into that, besides like little glimpses here and there or like implied extreme
I think the
violence.
Less violence you have, the more impactful it feels.
Yes.
Yeah, because the game gets very, AAA, violent, graphic, let's show all these, mangled bodies and stuff.
I've learned that if the camera suddenly zooms in and there's a lot of blood, you're about to die. That's a thing
game. You can turn that off, actually, like, while playing the game. Like, you can turn off,
like, I'm like, oh, no,
gore.
I think I'll... Well, I make fun of Joel and then Ellie getting killed a lot in the same way that my kid makes fun of me for a hook that used to work in Wii Bowling and now doesn't. And he just goes, oh, yeah, you hooked it a little bit to the right. I'm like, shut up and then move. You're not allowed to be in the house anymore. I have a question. So, thank you. First time Michael person?
Mycologist.
I study I. Michael Hurley. Here's the thing. So Melanie Linsky, I get the feeling. So when she opens up questioning, is that Tommy, the guy on the floor? Or that's the guy who was
the
Tommy?
The guy on the floor is a doctor who I think I don't know that we have a name. John Getz as doctor.
But she's putting the arm on him because she wants information. So the names that she's asking is like, have you seen these people? Do you know these people? Is that right? Like,
Sam. They don't mention Sam in the episode, but yes, Henry.
What I got from that was that she is looking, well, and certainly through what happens in the rest of the episode, it seems like she is, would you call that vengeance or would you call that justice? Or what, and then when she opens the cell and just shoots, apparently she just shoots somebody, what is her heart on? Like, what is her thing? What is Melanie Lynskey's thing? Is
it sounds like her brother was beaten to death by Fedra because somebody was giving them names on who, on probably who was involved in this insurrection. And it sounds like maybe the doctor wasn't directly involved, but this guy Henry, who is a character in the game, did snitch on her brother, which is why he's dead. So she's kind of seemingly leading this insurrection. Maybe her brother was before her, but yeah, she's out for, I don't know, as you put it, vengeance and justice are kind of synonymous in this world at this point, I think.
And she is dangling Henry over the rest of the people as the scapegoat for all these bad things are happening because of Henry. Find any collaborators and kill them, to the point where she kind of kills the doctor to prove a point that this guy is expendable in the search for Henry. And as we learn later, even insurrectionists in 2023, after 20 years of zombie apocalypse, can have PR problems, it sounds like, based on that same thing. And it's very interesting to see them overthrow Fedra to replace it with something just as evil, if not more incompetent.
We should also jump back as well to the scene in the laundromat with the guy who sneaks up on Joel.
Brian!
Brian, yes, poor Brian. Pretty pivotal for Ellie's character, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Joel is ambushed by Brian towards the end, and Ellie comes over with the same look in her eye as when she stabbed the zombie in the bottom of the Cumberland Farms in episode 3, and she just shoots Brian. I'm like, oh, I helped Joel. And then just like in that freaking scene in Chernobyl with the dog and the guy who was nominated for an Oscar, we have somebody with a gun for the first time shooting somebody, letting the person suffer, and then the people around them being made uncomfortable by the suffering. Maybe I'm just making too many Chernobyl connections, but dear God.
No, I think that's an effective trope. You think about like when the guy wings the deer in The Crown. By the way, just so y'all know, the deer is a metaphor in that show. No spoilers.
What?
But no, listen, seriously, you guys, I don't want to get into it, but it's on the King's Land is what I'm saying.
No. So,
yeah. I love the way she played that. I love the way everybody played that, and just that sense of like, oh, this is different and worse than I expected. This is really not a good feeling.
And we don't see Joel put Brian out of his misery in that moment. We linger on Ellie, who cries a little bit, wipes away some tears, and then tries to get right back into it and play off like nothing happened. Oh, yeah, I'm fine. Here's your flashlight. Here's your food. Let's just keep moving. And then they talk about it later, trying to paper over whatever happened.
Well, isn't he trying to like sort of prod her to talk about it, sort of say like, does he actually say like it's okay if you want to talk about it? Does he like when they're sort of hanging out?
Nope. He tries and fails miserably when he says, I'm not very good at this, am I? My favorite parallel.
Let's get back to the puns, please.
My favorite parallel here is that they talked about killing that guy like a normal dad and kid would have a sex talk. And earlier in the episode, the sex talk was just like, oh, that's fine, whatever, we'll laugh about this porn mag in the back of the truck. But nope, turns out they have like a very difficult, awkward conversation, if you ever want to, I guess, talk about it, maybe, about killing and not sex, like you would to a normal teen.
I think it was really nice in the game, or really nice change from the game, where in that, Joel is just immediately angry and aggressive towards Ellie. He's like, what the fuck were you thinking? You could have blown my head off. And you're like, I get that, you know, it's a pretty extreme reaction. Obviously, he was about to die, so that makes sense to some extent. But it's the world he lives in, and I think he would be more used to that kind of situation, I suppose.
So, you know what? I'm gonna really, really go beyond my knowledge here. I'm going to enter the worlds of both genre fiction and video games. And I was thinking how interesting it is the way they, to use a phrase you people use, that I think I know the meaning of, did a speed run through the world building the first episode. Like, they did stuff where, like, part of the fun, forgive me that I keep comparing this to The Walking Dead, but the first 4 or 5 seasons of that show, I really, really loved. And Well, of course, though. Yeah, exactly. But like it's one of the fascinating things in the first season and that extends in some ways through the whole series is that people are still figuring stuff out. I mean, there's a long time where they don't realize they thought, you know, you get bit and you turn into a walker. Well, let's start with Walker. That's just one of the names. Every group has a different name for what the show calls The Walking Dead, which they very rarely call zombies, if ever at all, right? Because it's regional. There's no Usenet for finding out, like, he's using it to get your binaries of The Walking Dead Season 3. You don't use it to talk about how we deal with these folks and, like, what it means. You know what I mean? Like, that whole first season, especially the first, like, five episodes, if memory serves, you're kind of walking through. It's like, these are the rules of the world. And I like the way, on the one hand, they did that in a very compact way on this show, but in so doing, I take a scene like that and I go, well, you know what? You know, like they say, anybody who's in politics, goes into politics, chooses to go into politics, is at least probably a narcissist and probably a little bit psychotic or, you know, but I'm sorry, I don't mean to be ableist. I'm not trying to, like, you know, but, you know, like, you have to be a little bit unusual to pursue politics in terms of your personality to survive the popcorn-headed people. Like, you have to be cut a little bit different. And I think Joel has seen his share of gunslinging hillbillies, you know? Like, I recently rewatched Looper. And there's that one guy who's always spinning his big gun around and saying a gat's better than a blunderbuss. And he's seen a lot of people shoot themselves in the foot trying to be tough. He's seen people take chances. I'm guessing. He's seen people take chances they didn't need to take. He's seen people he cared about go away because of someone else's error. And I'll bet you, so he doesn't really want to be doing this. He doesn't want to be trucking a kid around. This is a reach for him to be doing what he's doing. But I like the idea that, like, you know, you're 14 and of course you cannot be taught, you cannot learn anything. You're just going to have to, like, burn your hand on the stove. But yeah, you could have blown my head off. I've seen a lot of people do stupid stuff because they did not understand how this all works. So he's sort of like, there's the overt stuff of, like, he's seen what works and doesn't at a given time, the patterns and anti-patterns of surviving the popcorn head apocalypse title. But he also, I think he does care about her, but he doesn't want to die. And does that work at all for you guys? That, like, this is 20 years in. He's seen a lot of stuff happen. He's from before the event. He knows how things were different, and I've seen a lot of good people die with their face down in the mud, and he doesn't want to have it all over again where he's got to, like, scrape this teenager into a stolen car.
No, absolutely. The fact that she is someone who was born after the apocalypse, and the way that he approaches her about it, he mentions, you're just a kid, it's so unfair for you to have to deal with this in this way. That's the exact same thing somebody would have said before the zombie outbreak, and this is the first time that we know of. I'm sure it is the first time he's had to deal with this since his daughter. This is the first time he's had to comfort somebody through something like this in a way that they don't already have a context for the rest of the world. He also mentions at one point, you haven't seen the world, I know what the world was like, so I'm fighting for that.
I think there's also a sense, on one hand, he's trying to, you know, be a bit of a parent, be a bit of a counselor to Ellie and be like, nobody should have to do what you have done at your age. But you also get the sense that he is now recognizing her as more of a person rather than just a series of obligations and going, oh, you're a survivor. You know, you're willing to kill this dude because he was going to kill me. Like,
he can tell that she can adapt. She's got the skill. It's not just about being a good marksman. It's not about, you know, right? I mean, isn't a big part of it the ability to have situational awareness in a moment, but then on a broader...
To be able to pull the trigger.
Yeah, but also to, like, be able to, yeah, to adapt, to go, like, well, I don't have this one... you know, rubric or codex for running my life. Like, yeah, it's like whoever's alive at the end of the day, what do you people say? The thing every day on the other side of the turf is a good day, something like that.
We people, the UK.
You people. That's what they call you people. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm one of you people. Did you know that? My people fled the famine too. Hakuna Matata. But that's part of it is like I don't want to be out with some ding-a-ling who's out there waving a gun around, doesn't know what they're doing. And like, but then there's so much inside of that. Like, here's ways to not attract attention to yourself. If you are going to like kill somebody, here's how you kill them. This is years into this, and like, we're seeing the disconnect. You know, there's a phrase that people started using in the mid-90s, the September that never ended, when AOL, you know, introduced the internet to a lot of Americans. And like, you know, it became like September at every college, where there was this entire new generation of people who didn't know netiquette and everybody had to relearn it. He's dealing with somebody who's been on the inside. And there's all kinds of ways that this is going to be a stretch for both of them.
And the thing that winds up bonding Ellie and Joel in that moment was Ellie saying, "It wasn't my first time." And it was at that moment when Joel realizes, okay, I can actually talk to you and approach you in this way. And that's when he teaches her how to hold a gun properly. With one of my favorite moments in the episode, he grabs the gun, trying to take it out of her hand to demonstrate how good the grip is. And they both kind of have a little chuckle. The fact that, Merlin, have you and Billy played Left Behind yet?
Is that the one with the girl?
Yes.
No. We haven't. That's your question.
There was a clip of it in
the trailer.
That's
like a prequel with her girlfriend?
Yes, there was a clip of it in the trailer, and they've been hinting at it this entire time with, this wasn't my first time. I've hurt someone before.
You think we might get to see some before times stuff?
We're seeing some between 2003 and 2020.
We get to actually like see her getting the parts and building C-3PO. That's cool.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, God.
Too soon.
It's always too soon for Star Wars. Mm-hmm. What else? Kathleen looks through the apartment building for Henry and Sam. This is the scene that made me think, for such a drab, gray, apocalyptic world, there is a lot of color that they hide through there to make it look interesting. Even in this like old, burned-out apocalyptic apartment, there's a lot of peeling wallpaper. There's the drawings that Sam makes. There's a lot of just extra color thrown in there just to make it more interesting to look at, even though it does look a little bit like a nuclear reactor in Chernobyl. They're out of food. Henry will let them starve. And then Tommy shows Kathleen something. It is a giant crater that is rippling and moving around. Again, not unlike the steel bars popping
back
and forth.
I really do not like that crater.
Big dislike.
It's not an inviting crater.
Do you think that's a bloater crater?
Yes.
To me, it's 100%. Like it's a little bit like anchovies. Like, I like anchovies a lot, but I sure as hell want to know if something has anchovies, or for God's sake, raisins. Enough with the raisins. I would like some warning about a sinkhole that undulates, is all I'm saying.
You keep saying Tommy. That guy's name isn't really Tommy, is it?
No, it is not Tommy. Thank you for catching that.
Okay, yeah, you're just stressing me out. I'm like, no, that's not Tommy. Don't confuse everyone.
He played Tommy in the show.
It's because he's the actor who voices Tommy.
Yeah. But it's not Tommy. Yeah.
In my notes, he's called Game Tommy. Sorry, that's on me.
Game Tommy. GT.
He has a name.
His name is GT. It's fine.
I had a funny moment when he appeared, because I was like, oh, he sounds kind of familiar. Is that Troy Baker who voices Joel? And I'm like, I don't know Troy Baker that well. I don't think he really looks like that. Like, maybe they gave him like a fake beard or whatever. But like, that seems like a lot of work for like cameo. And then immediately after, I was like, I saw online that was the voice of Tommy, and I was like, mm-hmm. That makes much more sense.
Is that just FYI off the dome? Is that a recommended game? The one, Left Behind.
Yeah, it's kind of just deal. It's like extra content for Last of Us.
Yes, okay. It's in your part one remaster that you two are playing.
Oh, terrific! Okay.
Yeah, it's a really quick playthrough, and it's about Ellie before she gets involved in all this.
But also tied in with the winter section of the story, isn't it, I think?
No, that's different. That's just another chapter in the game.
I thought Ellie is like sneaking through the mall to look for supplies.
Yeah, it is separate from that in the main game, but in order to make DLC and tie it back into the game, I think what Naughty Dog did was they chose a moment in the game where not much was happening. There was a big, you know, time jump, and show us what Ellie was doing in that time jump while she was taking care of Joel, and use that to tell the story of Left Behind. My roommates and I were actually talking about this. Will they do that same thing in the show? Will it be a episode-long flashback like Bill and Frank, or is it going to be interspersed back and forth like they did in the game? And I guess we'll find out in a few weeks. What do we tell the others? Not yet. And Kathleen decides not to tell them. And here's the PR issue, because they've got to show that they are strong. They got to show that they are looking for Henry and try to be, you know, as tough about it as possible. So we're not going to worry about the giant bloater in the crater just yet. The crater reminded me a lot of the steel beams in Chernobyl in the last episode when it was popping up back and forth and kind of rippling. That was very, very creepy. I love Melanie Lynskey from Yellow Jackets, particularly from last year. Yellow Jackets is the most desperate I've ever been for a season two of something. And in March, on Friday, March 19th, we are getting Yellow Jackets season two freaking finally.
I can recommend, this was recommended to me by my friend Alex Cox. I'd never seen, guys, I'm a grown up. I'd never seen But I'm a Cheerleader.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a delight. And it's got some bangers. Like the cast of that, obviously, you know, it's got a young and totally adorable Natasha Lyonne. It's got Melanie Lynskey. It's got, I always forget her name, the wonderful woman from Veep. You know, the,
I know who you're
the one
talking
who gets
about.
Married to Catherine's
either.
Daughter.
Yeah.
She has like a French name, I think. Highly RuPaul. Recommended. Great. RuPaul. RuPaul is, it's not what I was thinking of, but yes, RuPaul is in it.
So
but it's so campy. It's so campy. It's like, I think Melanie Lynskey, you know what? Can I give you a weird factoid, Brady's Bits?
Please do.
That she used to be married to the actor Jimmy Simpson?
No, really? What?
Hand to God, they're still really good friends and they're adorable with each other on Twitter.
Oh my God, that's absolutely
absurd.
Yeah,
I'm seeing that here. 7 years.
Isn't that wild?
Bizarre. I do feel the moment where she was like, oh yes, let's not tell anyone yet, was a little bit like a look to camera. Tune in next week for the plucky adventures of our ragtag group of killers. Just
Joel
a little bit pointed. I was like, yeah, this is not the end of this story.
Joel and Ellie find a high rise to hang out in, and they spend some time walking up the stairs. This is where we get that moment of, have you killed innocent people? And I think that moment of her trying to kill Brian and failing changed her in a way that if she knew, or if she had asked this a day ago, this wouldn't have messed her up as much as it seems to in this moment. But they walk up the stairs and take a break to talk about the things that Joel had done in the before times to survive. And we've seen Joel do this a few times where he says, we're not helping this guy on the street. We're not helping these people in 2003 who are running and they've got kids. So do we. A bunch of times when
it's
Joel...
Like, it's like the first time you encounter an unhoused person and you're going through Manhattan and somebody's... Or like, you know, the famous one, the guy who's like, oh, I just need $5 for gas. I have to go. I have a job interview and pick up my kids. And somebody going, well, look, no, I just, you know, in that case, I'm not trying to be hard-hearted about this. It's that I just... Anything that involves you taking out your wallet on Avenue of the Americas is probably a thing you want to avoid. Anything where you take... You know what I'm saying? It's just something you learn over time. And like, yeah, if you want to give to a charity, give to a charity. But like... And again, well, I'm getting into a thing here and I don't mean to. But you know what I'm saying? It's one of those things where you're like, you know, you can't help everybody. And in fact, the people you seem to be helping, it's probably a good idea just to steer completely clear of them because you never know.
The likelihood of happening across somebody who was just grievously wounded moments before you appeared don't seem
Hello,
super
I'm
high
recently
in this world.
Bloody.
Oh, what incredible timing. Here's a cinder block to the windshield. They take a break, and Ellie says, get up, you lazy ass, which Joel replies, I'm 56 years old, you little shit, which I love that little moment. Joel sprinkles glass everywhere, crunch, 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 so that he can be woken up in the middle of the night. Spoiler alert, it does not work. And I love that their little, like, bunk bed, sleepaway camp, nighttime conversations get more and more real as they go. You know, last night, camping under the stars, we hear them talk about, is anyone going to find us? No, no one's going to find us. And then this time, they talk a little bit more about, does it get easier when you get older? No, not really. More bonding between the two of them in a way that I think this episode does a wonderful job of contrasting the beginning and the end in just 45 minutes, much shorter than the other episodes we've had so far.
The moments at the end there where they're sleeping on the little couch cushions, Joel is half asleep, she tells their diarrhea joke, and then Joel is just like, that's stupid, shut up, go to sleep. And then he just breaks and you're just like,
right,
yes,
exactly. That's
such a real
sweet
human
and feels,
dad moment.
It feels earned. It doesn't feel, I don't know, you know, it's like on a reality show, the person who's calling home to family to talk about what a difficult their week they're having on Top Dress, yeah, that person's out. They'll be out this week or next week. As soon as somebody calls their family at home, like, they're out. And, like, when you get that, you know, you're just waiting for that person to get fridged in the service of the story because now you cared about them a little bit. I thought it was well done.
This whole episode was about building the trust between Joel and Ellie. I mean, we've seen from previous episodes, Ellie begging to have a gun, like just begging for it, like every step that she possibly could. And Joel being like, no, I'm not going to get shot by some kid. It's not going to happen. And then having them experience that situation together where she reveals her stolen gun. And it's like this weird tension between him being thankful that she was there and had that hidden gun, but at the same time not wanting to condone that action, and him still not completely trusting her with the gun. And it's like as they've been building, and then he finally, like, through their conversation, through going through this, you know, which we just spent an hour discussing, them coming together and him showing her how to properly hold the gun, that then as they're walking up the stairs, they're starting to, like, trust each other in just everyday kind of things, like which way should they go, you know, when this happens we're gonna wait for, you know, no trucks to make a noise and then we're gonna run, like, trust me, like, get in this hole and hide, trust me for that, like this back and forth, all of this trust between these two characters. And then finally that, like, that lighthearted moment of them laughing at this joke together, there's also a lot of trust being shown in that moment, because it's like she, after this heavy conversation, she breaks the ice with this stupid joke, which is just so very, very funny. And it's like he gets to let his guard down now because they're becoming a little bit more even here. Like he is trusting her a lot more, even though she didn't put the gun in her backpack like she was supposed to. She puts it in her pocket.
It goes both ways
still.
Because they're both learning what to expect from the other. Like,
yeah.
Like, you tell me, the thing is, you can tell me who you are through Facebook, or you can show me who you are again and again in how you respond to things, what kind of, if you like, character that you have. And I think they're getting more of the sense of what they can expect from each other. Neither one has gotten erratic, you know, and they're erratic within normal parameters. And I think that's what we're seeing. So now there's finally a little bit of room. Let's see, this is how you die in one of these things. You get a little bit of room for the human heart.
I mean, that's what's, like, so great about this. Like, there's so many complicated emotions going on, because you can tell that Joel is, like, super thankful that she's so capable, but he still is very hesitant to trust her. And as the audience, we know all of Joel's baggage with, like, hanging out with this 14-year-old girl all of a sudden. Like, obviously, we know his... you know, his reservations because of what happened with his daughter and how painful that is. And then we also know, like, Ellie has this baggage too that she's carrying around that she's not talking to Joel about. And, like, I guess the audience doesn't know quite what Ellie's baggage is unless you've played the game, and then you do. And so it's like all of these heavy things and them building this relationship together as they're going through this extreme test of endurance and wills and stamina and nerves. Like, that's what is so beautiful about both this story and the game story. It's like, they're, like we keep saying, like, it's for people like feelings and guns, like, because this is so human of a story, and yet we're seeing, like, both the best sides and the worst sides of humanity in these post-apocalyptic things. And I think that that's what draws everyone in so much.
You've also got to imagine that Joel just constantly has Sarah on his mind. Just, I don't know, she was maybe 12 or 13, a little younger than Ellie when she dies.
Right.
But so similar in age that, you know, how could you not constantly be thinking about it? And going, oh, you know, maybe she would have enjoyed a road trip across America, but nothing about Sarah's personality that we see in that half of the first episode suggests that she would have been able to shoot a guy in the back.
Mm-hmm. No, no.
Brian, can I say one thing about parenting that you should cut out?
Yes.
Except you may not. I don't know. I don't listen to podcasts. There's a thing that happens when you got a kid that you got to take care of. This is probably true for pets too, but I don't know. But, like, you're raising a kid and, like, taking care of, or, like, being the steward of another person is rarely easy, but it can be more or less simple. So, like, there's a point in your kid's life where it's like, just keep this kid from, you know, dying. Just keep this kid from, like, you give it food, you change the diapers, you do all the stuff. I'm not trying to be sentimental, but what I am trying to say is there's a point in that process where it's mainly your job to say no to everything. And that's understandable, right? No, you can't play in traffic. No, you can't have a gun. All of those kinds of things. You can certainly imagine a world where you could imagine, God willing, your kid grows up and eventually gets to a point where they have agency. Well, guess what? There's a big continuum in between. And I think some of the most challenging stuff that you run into, which he would have been running into around the time that he lost her, one of the things you're running into is where is it no longer sufficient to just say no? Or where is it no longer sufficient to just say no and here's why? Isn't there a world where at this point, even in a suburban family, for example, there's a lot of it's important that at some point we start working our way into this next thing and we start saying, if not yes, at least maybe and kind of and within these rules. Now take that to the next level. You know, if he can count on her because he has to count on her, he has to not say no to everything, like having a gun, right? He's been through this. So I think that's, to me anyway, that's another level of this is like he had somebody and lost them. But he also knows that the thing I've said and something I wrote fairly recently is like for parents, like your job for a lot of the time is to keep your kid from dying. But it's also super important at a certain point, especially in various ways, to not keep them from living. And in this case, for that kid to live, they have to not die. And so I'm going to have to loosen up a little bit of my protocols about how I think the world should work in order to create an environment, an adaptive, situationally aware environment where we do depend on each other. We do the safe things, but like you can't just say no forever.
It's like in The Prestige when Christian Bale goes, well, simple maybe, but not easy. And then he cuts off his finger to kind of blend in with no spoilers. And the fact that Joel is going the simple approach to say, no, you don't have a gun. No, you don't have a gun. Over time, it becomes the easy approach of, yes, you get to have the gun, but it's not as simple. It's a lot more complicated.
You know what you say? You say, we've already been through this. We'll talk about it when you're 16. That was my Oscar-nominated performance as 1970s dad.
I think what we need is a little scale that just goes from cargo to family. In each episode, we can just ratchet it up a notch.
Oh, it's like pets are meat. Yeah, they're all rabbits.
And then over time, the more that Joel talks to Ellie and connects with her, the more that he can say, I've liked you now more than I've ever liked you in the past.
Oh. Stupid baby. Did you guys talk about when those two guys kissed on that one episode? Did you guys talk about that?
I don't think so. Did,
we did.
Two
we
men
had
kissed?
Some feelings.
It's pretty good when those guys kissed. I like that
I have
part.
No idea what you're talking about. No, that was
you're like blank check. We're like recording these out of order.
Oh my God. Imagine recording episode 6 before watching episode 3.
I would like to nominate that the title of this episode be Ellie's Got a Gun.
Oh, jeez.
Ellie's Got a Gun.
What's the name of the author of the pun book? What's his name?
Oh,
something
I
Williams?
Can't
you just bested him. Like
Will
that was
Livingston?
Welcome to the dad joke club. That was good, Tiff. That was really embarrassing and not funny.
Oh, right? I just saw a really good one though. It's like I make all these dad jokes, but I'm not a dad. I guess I'm a faux pas.
Wow. Oh, that's excellent.
Oh, man. God, unintentional abstinence. It's not something you plan for, but here I am.
Anything else to throw in before we wrap up the episode?
No.
I saw a piece of popcorn. I saw a piece of popcorn on the floor, and I thought it looked like a clicker.
It does. So, they do look like popcorn faces.
Next time you notice some popcorn that fell on the floor. Sorry, Mad. Next time you notice some popcorn, I'm just saying the system works because I'm seeing clickers now.
Trudge had their filling pop out a few days ago and they're going to the dentist tomorrow. Ooh. But that means for the first time, we have not had popcorn while watching The Last of Us. And so next time I got to watch The Last of Us with popcorn and see if that impacts my experience.
I'm also making popcorn next time for sure.
My experience is like coffee and cereal. It's a very different vibe.
Oh, of course. It's like watching SNL on a Sunday morning.
Yeah.
And before we wrap up, we've got Mushroom of the Week. And Merlin, you sent us a lovely picture of what I think should be Mushroom of the Week. Tell us about your new
Oh my gosh.
Friend.
Oh, it's an honor to be nominated. Yeah, my kid and I grow mushrooms sometimes on purpose. I got you a better picture. That I sent you a photo of my mushroom. What would you call that? What's the collective noun of a mushroom clod? But that's under my grow lamp, so it looks kind of weird. This is a kind of thing that you can get from the Washington Fulfillment Company. We'll send you a mushroom thing, like a block, and not a brick that you throw at a zombie, but a little brick, and you water it, and it's in a little bit of light, and then it grows a whole butt ton of mushrooms, and it's really great. I'll send you a better one to put into the actual notes if you choose to, but it's very beautiful and I love it very much. I left here on Friday and it looked like you ever walk around in a swimsuit like, and then you get like that kind of road rash between your legs. It looked like that, but now today it's a full on big ass bunch of mushrooms, and it's very upsetting. I like to think of it as being in honor of our visit today, and I love it very much.
But you haven't named it yet.
Oh, let's see. Did I name it? I feel I don't see. That's the thing, is if you name it, you get into that pets or meat situation. I don't intend to eat these
McCool.
mushrooms.
I mean, come on.
Shroomy McCool is not bad. I don't hate that. Huh.
Last week we talked about how mushrooms. I keep getting Instagram ads for Joel's coat from Huckberry. Now I'm keep getting Instagram ads for those Washington Fulfillment Company mushroom growing kits that you can buy.
That's exactly the one. Oh, man. Maybe we're on the same IP address, Brian.
Look,
I'm just going to say you and Trude should move as soon as possible. Take nothing. There's a truck running outside. It's got a gun. Get
in your apartment to see when Merlin appears.
Crunch, crunch, crunch.
I like your hair like that. Oh, my gosh. Y'all look so pretty.
Merlin, I second that nomination. Thank you so much for bringing a mushroom, and I hope that Shroomy McCool has a long and happy life in your office. But not too long.
I don't want it to take over. But, you know, I don't get a vote. Thank you all for having me. It was a delight.
Yeah, Merlin, thank you so much for joining us. This has been an absolute blast. I realize I've never thanked Tiff and Ben for being on the show before until episode 5. So, Tiff, thank you so much for hanging out with us.
You don't need to thank your co-hosts.
I know, but still, I want to. Ben, thank you so much for spending time.
You're very welcome. Glad to be
here. Well, thank you, Brian.
Hey, Brian, thank you.
You're doing the lion's share of the work on these.
You are.
I was going to wait till we were off the air, but I want the people listening here. Hey, Brian, you did a really good job hosting this. It's hard to do.
What?
And you did a really nice job with it.
Oh, thank you. You're very, very sweet. Tune in for next week to hear another, hopefully very, very good job, Raves Merlin Man, about the podcast that you're listening to right now, The Cast of Us.
Could have been a lot worse, Raves Merlin Man. A lot more organization than I'm used to. I usually get to talk the whole time.
Have a great night, everyone.